just a bloke in a bar.
What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Bloke in a Bar, powered by Bloke Beer. Aussie spirit in a can. It's a beer for blokes that turn up for family, mates, and good times. I'm here with Ben Damon. Mate, I was gonna describe you, but pre-podcast, you're a man of many, almost a chameleon?
A chameleon? Yeah, you could go with that. A schemer, a survivor at times. Yeah. No, it's great to be here, Denon. Thanks for having me. Really pleased to have a chat with you. First and foremost, I think you're coming to Vegas with us. Is that right?
I am coming to Vegas.
Oh, what a good rort. So you're a schemer as well.
I am a schemer. They were like, they said, hey, listen, would you be kind of interested? Almost asking me as if it was a silly question. Like, yeah, he's not going to be interested. I was like, yes, I'm interested. Lock me in. Keen ass.
And you've been to Vegas before, I take it?
I have, but it was on a footy trip with the Dragons. Okay. So I think it's going to be a slightly different...
I hope it's a bit different to that. certainly. This is my 21st Vegas trip. So,
no way.
Yeah, so that's a lot. Too many, you'd say. But, I can't wait for this one with a huge Australian fight and a big contingent with people like you. So, yeah, exciting. But, in terms of me, yes, mainly the boxing at the moment. Yep. And certainly in the last decade or so. But, lots of other bits and pieces. It's been a journey, but in Australian boxing, it's such an exciting time, and it's great to be a part of it.
Now, you said you've been said 21 times?
21. This will be 21.
Lucky 21.
Yeah, I would hope so, yeah.
But the first time you went, was it like a trip or was it boxing?
No, the first time I went was just a trip. Yep. It was off the back of a holiday to Europe and I met a mate there. They lost my luggage, actually. I didn't have any luggage in Vegas for 4 days, which not really a problem, to be honest.
Oh, really?
It was fine because you know what happens in Vegas. It was an interesting experience and everything that I was excited about on the way into Vegas on that first occasion, like the pokies in the airport and everything else, was everything that I absolutely hated when I was leaving because you come to dread those trips by the end of them.
Like LED lighting.
Yeah. Let me leave. Yeah. But now mainly it's been boxing.
What was your first card that you went over there for? Because that's probably you remember the most.
Yeah, I went over for a bunch of major sort of international cards before we had many Aussies fighting on them. But some of the bigger ones, I did the Fury Wilder event and dealt with both of those fighters in
number
the lead up.
One?
Number two. The first one was in LA. The second one I did. It was a great experience because all the Poms were going crazy. Yeah. Obviously, he was brilliant, Tyson Fury. Wilder was great to deal with. And it's good over there because we're a rights holder as main event. So you get a bit of an inside running, as you'll find out. Yeah. You're not treated like with the slop, with so many other like YouTubers and networks. We actually have sort of a seat at the table. So you get to get up close and personal with all of these guys and be a part of these really big fight weeks. And the idea of doing that when we've got Tim Zhu, in a great fight against Sebastian Fundora now, and also Michael Zarafa on the card, who knows what he's going to do against Erislandy Lara. It's really exciting. So those cards sort of that I've been a part of in history are all brilliant, but when you've got an Aussie in the main event in a unified world title fight, this is another level.
Oh, man. And to think, you know, if he wins this fight and then, you know, he goes on the trajectory, we hope he will, to think you're almost there at that, the last step into greatness to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah, well, every step is fascinating when you've been a part of someone's career like this. And I've been very blessed in my position in Australian boxing to sort of ride the wave with a number of guys. But Tim, since the start, I remember when he was making his debut and calling all the earlier fights that were televised, some of them in quite obscure venues with no one there, no one particularly interested, watching him get dropped in the first round against Wade Ryan at the casino and people going, oh, I'm not sure whether there's anything much here. And then seeing once he got on main event against Joel Camilleri in the Australian title fight and just took off after that, not only in terms of his popularity, which is obviously absolutely immense now, but in terms of his self-belief and his skill, he's become the real deal. And I think at a lot of times people feared that may not be the case, but now it just can't be denied. He's a freak. And the willingness that he has to go into fights like this on 12 days notice, essentially, he's doing things that not many are doing or have ever done.
Mm. I will say, you know, even I obviously wasn't watching Timmy as closely when, you know, right at the start, but I don't think he gets enough appreciation because he's such a well-rounded fighter now, and he's just dominated his last, you know, three or four opponents. I know he got dropped four fights ago in America, but outside of that, he just came back and killed it. I don't think he gets enough appreciation for how hard he's worked on his game, because I do think there was a period where I thought technically he was world class, but I thought power wise, I was like, I don't know, is his power going to be enough to? And ironically, heading into this fight, especially, that's his main weapon is his power. The fact he sits down and his punches. What have you noticed about his development as a fighter?
It's his belief, I think. Yeah. And I think that's where his power comes from, is the fact that now he's willing to sit down on his shots, and he creates pressure now like not many others do. He is just constantly exhausting his opponents, and it gives him an opportunity to take his shots, throw with power. And there was a big question mark. Everyone thought, oh, yeah, he looks great and he looks like his dad, but I don't know if he could punch like his dad.
Yeah.
And he hated that. Yeah. You could tell it tore him up. And it was probably a fair criticism. But the fight that I think really started to turn the corner for him, and it's a funny one because it was a fight where he blasted out his opponent, was when he fought against Jack Brubaker.
Yeah.
Jack Brubaker got in his face. Like, he's a great character. Like
Ken Seller fight.
Oh, yeah, he's brilliant. Like, you'd put him in with anyone tomorrow because he does your job for you.
Yeah.
But he got in Tim's face at all of the bits and pieces that we did in the lead up promotionally and at the weigh-in, and Tim had genuine anger in his eyes when I turned to talk to him after they'd had a bit of an exchange there. And I could tell this was a little bit different because he'd got under his skin and Tim got out there and he was mean. And that's when he started to sort of lean into that, what I then called the Soul Taker, and he sort of started to show that he wanted to hurt people and he wanted to hurt Jack Brubaker, and he did, and he hated when that fight got stopped. And then he just kept running with that from that moment on, and he started to believe that that was who he was and also that was what he wanted to do. So once he became that person, he has not gone anywhere close to going back.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm so impressed about his last, well, let's just say 3 or 4 years, is usually you get boxers or even any athlete and they'll take 4 steps forward, 1 step back, 4 step, and it's a natural part of progression. When you look at his last 4 or 5 years, there has been no steps back. It is just looking better and better and better. I mean, you could argue the stun drop knockdown in America, a little bit of a setback, but when you find out, you know, going into that camp and also going to that fight, he was quite sick. It's like, makes a lot of sense. And also it gave an opportunity to show his grit as well, to be able to come back from that. But he's just, his progress to the fighter he is now has been incredible. What's been your favorite moment on the mic with Tim? I'm not going to say my personally first. I want to hear your favorite moment on the mic.
Well, it's interesting because there's moments on the mic calling the fights.
Yeah.
And then there's interviews and press conferences and all of those sorts of bits and pieces. There's a couple of really memorable ones. Clearly, the fight never happened between Tim Zhu and Michael Zarafa, but we did a face-off. I don't even know if it ever got broadcast. I know bits of it did, the face-off between the two of them. When Michael Zarafa pulled out the Mickey Hatton line in reference to Ricky Hatton having stopped Tim's dad in his last fight. And I saw Tim just change in that moment. And it was a brilliant line from Zarafa. I loved it because I was hosting it. And you need those moments. And that was the moment in that face-off. But just seeing him sort of freeze over and immediately want to destroy this person. He was so angry about it. That was a fascinating thing in terms of that outside the ring moment. But then in terms of calling his fights, well, the Dennis Hogan fight was a big moment because we were in Zoo Castle, as it became. The atmosphere was immense. And he produced a brilliant performance. I really like Dennis Hogan. He's a ripping bloke. But was
that the uppercut, the where he slipped that punch and
that crazy uppercut poor old Dennis bit through his tongue. I went and saw him afterwards, and his tongue was sliced to pieces. Like, and you don't wish that on. He came back and won a version of a world title after that, Dennis Hogan. But he was in a really bad way, a busted nose, tongue. And then at the end of it, that's when I lent into the Soul Taker thing, sort of took a gamble on trying to give someone a nickname, which often goes very badly, but thankfully he embraced it at the time. So that was really memorable. And the Tony Harrison fight, I think that was the real coming of age in terms of Tim going from an outstanding domestic fighter and a star of Australia to being a fully fledged global star and someone who people had to fear. So yeah, lots of great moments.
My favorite moment is when he's on the mic saying, "Say my name, say my name." I love that. I was like, hell yeah, bro.
That's great. But when you're holding a microphone and someone starts screaming expletives, your immediate thought is, oh, I have to make this stop somehow. Yeah. There's no way of stopping that.
Yeah,
he's doing that with everyone roaring and loving it. Yeah. And thankfully, the people who employ me embraced it. Yeah. But yeah, like I'm pretty used to holding the mic when people start swearing. we have boxers and footy players turn boxers all the time who are just in a moment of stress and a moment of madness who'll start screaming expletives. And when he did that, I was like, I don't think he should be doing that, but I don't think there's much I can do about it at this point.
Great TV.
And it's turned into something big. I saw some of the promos for this fight in the United States and they're leaning into that moment.
Yeah.
And obviously it references his dad without having to reference his dad, which is such a great selling point still in the United States. So it was a cool moment, no doubt.
And for yourself, mate, have you always been, is a sports fan and then you've slowly moved into boxing, or you've just always loved? I mean, you did a bit of boxing growing up?
Yeah, no, I've always loved boxing. A bit of boxing in my family. My grandfather was a boxer and his brothers fought back at the old Sydney Stadium. I've always been around boxing in some capacity, and it's a little bit of a story how I started boxing myself. But I was a teenager trying to watch the Mike Tyson comeback fight against Peter McNeely. I think it was 1995. Looking around pubs in Glebe to watch it on Sky Channel through the windows at that stage because I was underage. And we got to the Cowrie at Glebe. We were watching through and they had it on and the door opened and a bloke came out and it was me and two mates. And we thought he was going to tell us to go away. Yeah. But a bloke goes, come in, you can watch the fight. And the bloke was Jeff Harding.
No way.
The light heavyweight champion of the world up until recently at that time.
What?
The bloke who had been in one of my favourite fights ever and still probably my favourite fight ever when he comes back from the dead against Dennis Andres. So he said, come in and we watched the fights, chatted with him at the end because I was a bit of a sports nerd, so I knew like a lot about horse racing and a lot about boxing and was a big rugby league guy at that stage as well. But I just knew everything about his career, so I showed off a little bit as you do when you're a kid. And he said, you should go down and do some training with Johnny. And I said, oh, how do you do that? And he said, just turn up tomorrow, being a Monday at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or whatever, and tell him that I sent you. So I did, and I lobbed up. And Johnny was there at Newtown Police Boys Club, iconic venue where Harding obviously trained, Jeff Fenwick trained, and Koshizu was training at that stage.
Wow.
So I walked in as a kid, 14, and Johnny was eating a hamburger and I had a fair bit of front. And I just said, oh, Jeff Harding told me to come down. He goes, oh, did he? in his own inimitable way. So, and I started training then, and I trained at Newtown for a long time after that. So I was hooked, and I was training in the gym while Kostya was there, which was great. Like in the lead up to world title fights, seeing him and bringing international sparring partners and getting to do sessions around and with them was quite an incredible process. And having the influence of Johnny Lewis in your life as well. People have described, obviously, the father figure that he is to so many people, and such an important figure in a lot of people's lives. His 80th birthday this week, actually. So,
Happy birthday, mate.
Yeah, happy birthday, Johnny. He won't be listening. I guarantee it. I don't think he knows what a podcast is.
What a podcast.
Yeah. So, that was sort of the beginning, and I was hooked from then. So I went into TV after that, did a lot of bits and pieces, read the news on Channel 7 and various other shows and bits and pieces, and then almost inevitably ended up back in boxing as my main source of income and passion.
How'd you go as a boxer?
Not good enough to make it a thing. I think it's one of those sports, if you don't believe you're going to be the best in the world, don't do it.
It's a very lonely sport.
Yeah. And one thing that I think I always lacked was discipline and the ability to cut out the other aspects of your life, which you just have to do. You have to be like a Tim Zoo. You have to be willing to say goodbye to so much. That's the stuff that I've leant into. So I don't think it was a match made in heaven. Like, I thought about it, played a lot of footy as well, and was fit and had all that going at that stage, certainly not now. But no, it wasn't my future. So yeah. I'm glad that I could have a role where I can still do those other things, not have to worry so much about willpower and still be around these big events.
And so you said you got into boxing as in from on the media side, but were there other jobs in between? And also, how did you land on the media side with it?
So I started during school, thanks to Johnny and others around the gym, got a bit of work with Roy Masters, just a work experience. At the Sydney Morning Herald when he was there and went in and, you know, he'd send me off to do this and to do that. It was only for a couple of weeks here and there and that was a great experience. And then one day he said to me, oh, do you want to go out? I'm not working on the Wednesday. Do you want to go out with one of the journos to Randwick races?
Yeah.
And I'd never used to go to school on a Wednesday anyway because I would go to the races every Wednesday anyway. So I said, yeah, I'm happy to go to the – I would have gone anyway. This occasion I had to get a jacket from somewhere. I think I went to Vinny's and had to wear a jacket because we were in the media room. But went out there and again just sort of showed off a little bit to the journo. Steve Mooney was his name. And I'd already done the form. I'd had a few winners on the weekend. The bloke at the tab near school used to let me put my school bag behind the counter while I was punting. So, I knew all about the rain. I just showed off. And then they brought me back to do bits of work with racing. I used to type up the form and that sort of stuff. Then when I finished school, I got shortboard into a job in radio, producer job. Then went from there to another radio station, then ended up in TV at Channel 10 Sports Tonight. Channel 7 approached me, went there, ended up reading the sports news, the 6 o'clock sports news and doing Sunrise and stuff like that and hosting on racing coverage. Then went freelance after that and have worked for everyone.
Really?
Freelance for absolutely everyone. Then I obviously have fallen into the boxing since 2009. I've done all the fights, but also a lot of horse racing. So I've been fortunate to work on Melbourne Cup coverages and Cox Plates and Golden Slippers and all that. So it's, it's great. It's what I would have wanted to do when I was putting my school bag behind the tab and then going off to Johnny's gym. So it's worked out all right.
It's like a bloke like yourself and like myself is you get paid to do something that you would literally be doing at a pub anyway, talking about sport.
Yeah, but you have to bring yourself back to that because sometimes with the politics of TV and boxing, like what am I doing working between those worlds? But with everything that can go on, sometimes you're like, oh, that doesn't seem fair or that's not right. But you go, hang on, what are you worried about, mate? Like this could have gone a very different way.
Yeah.
So you just have to reflect and be gracious and be grateful because it's fantastic. I'm just so blessed to have the seat that I have for these events is remarkable. I would pay anything for that, but I get paid to do it. I'm so lucky and I know that. I keep that in mind all the time. And I think you have to because otherwise, particularly in a commentary role, I think if you do sort of go the other way with it and take things for granted, I think it would come across and I think
you'd
it can.
Feel it, I think, yeah. I think you can, as a listener, you can feel that same joy and love of being there. You can, if it isn't there, you can definitely feel it.
I think. Yeah. And my number one spot, I'm not trying to use boxing to get anywhere else. Like that's where I wanted to get to.
Yeah.
So I'm not thinking, oh, I'd love to do this or I'd love to do that. Like that's where I am. So I'm just so lucky to have got to this spot for now until, you know, whatever happens. But it's the end goal really. So I just want to exist in that and continue to do it as long as I can.
Yeah. And you said you did some anchor work with Seven?
Yeah, Seven. Yeah.
Give us an insight as a person.
It's just reading the auto cue.
Ron Burgundy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like as a bloke that, you know, I played footy, but I didn't do anything with any mainstream whatever. I just started a podcast and been fortunate enough that it's gone.
Well, I've worked for all of them and been punted from all of them as well. So I can give you all the stories.
Perfect. But like, guess what's an insight into a job like that? You know, is there any unique thing that a lot of people don't realize with that job or what's it like?
It was kind of funny for me starting that because my first TV job was at Sports Tonight when that was the thing on Channel
Sports
10.
Sports Tonight,
Yeah,
that's
so
a throwback.
Yeah, right. It's crazy. It's a shame that's not still around, to be honest. It was a great show.
Yeah,
and I used to watch it all the time and then I got to work on it. And it was a really good show to work on. There was a lot of young-ish people working who were just really passionate about sport.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was a little bit at that stage, because it was late at night, it was at 10, it was a little bit like you were playing reserve grade sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So then Channel 7 approached me, and I was only 24 or 25, and I went over and started reading the news almost straight away, the sports news and then the news at times as well.
Yeah, wow.
And I was too young for that. Okay. And too young to be dealing with all of that stuff, you know, around commercial television, ratings, politics.
Yeah.
Like, just, it was crazy. I really enjoyed it, but it was difficult. It was really difficult to be a part of that machine and I never wanted to be that, read the news or anything. Like, yeah. I wanted to, you know, do whatever else. So I didn't even really know what I wanted to do, but I'd ended up there. So it was tricky, but at the same time, it was, for want of a better term, it was a piece of piss job.
Yeah, like, okay, really.
You're reading an auto cue for 3.5 minutes. Really the hardest thing is your body language, like just looking interested and getting it right. If you are okay at doing that naturally, if you can present, then it's not that difficult a role, but everything around it is so difficult.
Yeah, okay.
So the on-air stuff was great, and I was fine with it, and I didn't find it difficult. I don't know, people might have thought I was terrible at it, but others obviously thought I was good, and I got the jobs. But the other stuff's the tricky stuff in that industry.
Man, I can imagine. I can only imagine.
Yeah, there's stories, but lots of them are
locked away in the vault.
Yeah.
So you come, when you did come originally into boxing, was it straight into boxing, or were you kind of, you freelance boxing, you freelance other stuff, and then obviously become full time?
I was freelancing with a lot of stuff, racing and boxing mainly. What happened is there was a show called The Contender that was about to start.
Oh, The Contender.
Yeah, so I got approached by the late Brian Walsh, who asked me to go and host that show originally, because I was freelancing and he knew I was freelancing. It didn't work out that I hosted that show, but I did help them with some bits and pieces around that. But as a result of doing that, and I actually helped them when they needed someone to go on it after a late withdrawal with Garth Wood, who was a mate of mine, who ended up winning the show, who I'm still mates with.
Beat Anthony Mundine.
Anthony Mundine in a fight that I hosted. But around that time, they needed someone to come in at late notice and call a fight.
Yep.
So they approached me, and it just happened to be a Daniel Gill world title fight.
Wow.
When he beat Sebastian Phil Sylvester to win the IBF middleweight world title from Germany. So I did that, which was incredible. And then I went on the journey with Daniel Gill, went to Germany with him when he fought against Felix Sturm, which was a brilliant experience, the second fight when he unified the middleweight titles, because I was there in a media capacity, but they were lacking a corner man. They had one short, so they actually asked me to be in the corner.
What?
I'd never been in a professional boxing corner before.
Wow.
And I never will again, because the only time that I ever have been an Australian unified the middleweight world title in Germany.
You can't go.
I'm not going again.
Not with
like, you know, some bloke up at the Horden or something who's going to get beat. But
local RSL bloke.
It's crazy. So that was a fantastic experience. And at a point, my job was just to put the towel over him, take his mouth guard out, wash it, that sort of stuff. Pretty basic. But then he got a cut on my side, and he had another bit of damage here. So Brian Wilmot, one of the best cut men in Australia, goes, "I'm going to handle this one. You get that one." And I was like, "Well, hang on a minute. Like, I think we're going a bit deep here, but that's not a bad spot. You just put a bit of Vaseline on." So I was all right. And he's a genius, Brian, with what he does. So, got through it. And then there's photos in the ring afterwards where everyone's jumping up and down, but just in the back of shot, you can see me celebrating like completely. Usually you have to try and, you know, maintain a bit of decorum, and I just didn't after that, because I wasn't working. I was, you know, just there for the ride.
Fan.
Yeah, that was incredible. And that trip in its entirety was one of the greats as well, because I'd just come from hosting on the Olympic coverage in London in 2012 with Foxtel. Well, I got to host the Olympics, which was a great experience as well, and then went straight to Germany and cornered an Aussie winning a world title or unifying a division. So that was great. Just unbelievable, some of that stuff.
Now, you've had some pretty incredible moments. You know, obviously you've main evented some of the biggest names in boxing. You've been over to Vegas and you just listed some incredible moments, but I'm pretty sure this is your biggest moment. It says you were a finalist in the 2009 Clio Bachelor of the Year competition.
I was unemployed at that stage too. So I for a moment it looked like I was a chance of winning. I didn't. I definitely didn't. But I think I would have been the first unemployed winner of the Clio Bachelor of the Year competition, which would have been fantastic.
How does that come about?
Rang. They just rang and said, do you want to go in this thing? And I didn't have a lot going on at that point. I'd left full-time employment at Channel 7 and I had a bit of gardening leave.
Yeah.
So I couldn't actually go anywhere else for a little bit.
A competitive thing.
But so I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And it turned into a good little rort because I ended up emceeing a lot of their functions and stuff. But yeah, I was thinking this will be interesting. Like if I have to make a speech or, you know, everyone's got all these big backers behind them and I was just sort of in the pub, like exclusively in preparation. And they wanted me to get my shirt off in the photos as well. I was like, I don't think it's the right time for that. I think we should leave that. So yeah, that was a real highlight.
That was great. And now another really cool thing, I didn't know this, but you're a filmmaker. You debuted a feature film, won Best Documentary at London International Film Festival, amongst other awards. Walk us through that. What was the film and how did that come about?
Yeah, that's I've made a lot of shorter films and television, but I've only completed the one feature so far, and it was actually a boxing story. Most of my stuff hasn't been boxing related, but this one was, and it was about an Australian who was born in Cameroon, Sakio Bika. You may have seen him fight previously. He won a world title eventually, the WBC super middleweight world title. Fascinating character. Grew up in a little hut with 11 people in it in Douala in Cameroon, with open sewers around him and everything. So anyway, we did the story of his life, and because of his style, which is completely untaught, just wild. And if there are any boxing fans watching this, or even if you just are interested in good fights, go and have a look at Sakio Bika against Jadon Codrington. It was the final of the American Contender, one of the series. It's the probably the best fight you'll ever see. Wow. Sakio is just an animal. He's just a really good friend of mine, and just an incredible fighter. But because of his style, he's attracted a lot of big name support. So people like Oscar De La Hoya, Mike Tyson, Roy Jones Jr., all those sorts of guys, they consider Sakio one of their favorite fighters.
Wow.
Because of where he came from and the way that he fights. He also fought and gave their hardest fights to people like Andre Ward, Joe Calzaghe. He got robbed against Marcus Bayer in Germany for a world title. Eventually, he beat Marco Antonio Perabon and won a world title, which was a culmination of an incredible life. But because of all those names, I was able to use other connections and get all those people.
Yeah.
So I actually got Mike Tyson to be an executive producer on the film.
No way.
Sam Neill narrated the film.
I've got to watch this.
The timing wasn't great because it came out just at the start of COVID.
Yeah.
So we did about 3 weeks of festivals, won heaps of stuff, and then the festivals all got canned. But we got Best Documentary at London. I got nominated Best Director at Milan. Didn't get to go though, unfortunately, but great experience and got to spend time with those names that I talked about, like a couple of days with Tyson in Vegas, De La Hoya and Roy Jones and all sorts of people, Sugar Ray Leonard, others.
No way.
Yeah.
Is that something you've always, you know, aspired to do, is create your own, you know, I call it content because of the generation, I guess.
Yeah.
Documentaries and filming that?
Yeah. Well, not really. I've never really aspired to do any of the things, but I when an opportunity's come up, I've taken it. And I had a couple of short films that went really well. So that gave me an opportunity to work on.
What's the name of the documentary? Sorry.
It's called Le Champion.
Le Champion.
That's what they call him in Cameroon.
And where
Cameroon.
Can you get?
It's difficult to find at the moment because it's in the hands of Screen Australia. They're meant to be selling it. I don't know what's happened to it. I've sort of moved along.
Okay, I'm assuming it's quite a timeless story. So whenever it probably does get released, it'll still be just as interesting as it was.
Well, I would have liked it to get released a way ago. But it turns out that dealing with people in the film industry is a little bit like dealing with people in the boxing industry and the racing industry and TV. So, I dealt with a couple of snakes. But the film got its little run. People can still find that it succeeded, which is good. So I'm glad that you saw that. For Sakio's sake, I'd really like that it got on a streaming platform in Australia. So hopefully that happens soon. I know there's some talk about that.
But you can find it if you want to look for it?
You'd have to look pretty hard.
Okay, so if, audience, look hard or don't look hard.
Yeah, look hard. I don't care.
Okay, it doesn't matter.
One day I'll just put it up.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah,
look hard, then, audience. Yeah,
but I did get to spend those couple of days with Tyson. Yeah. Which was a great experience. In that, everyone likes hearing about Mike Tyson. We got 2 days with him. So the first day was an interview. Man.
How does that, like, 2 days of his time?
Yeah.
You can't buy that.
No, well, yeah. So we got in touch with his partner, his wife, Kiki. Mm. I spoke to her. Very normal, professional person. Mm. And she understood the project, pitched it to him, I assume. And it was all on. So went over to Vegas. And first day was an interview at his office. I don't know why he has an office, but he does. And I think he was 3 hours late to his own office. And when he got there, we were all set up. I don't think it's a surprise or a secret that Mike doesn't mind smoking quite a lot of marijuana. And he clearly had been on this day.
Yeah.
But he turned up and the content was dark but amazing that he was giving me in this interview. But he took a lot of breaks and he came back and he was in various states when he did return it. And he cried, I think, 3 or 4 times during the interview. It went for about 4 hours, the interview.
Wow.
He laughed like hysterically to the point it was awkward a few times. He got up and stormed out twice with all these mics on him and everything. And the second time I thought he was going to hit me.
No way.
And then at the end of it, he walked across, knocked like everything over and hugged me and told me that he loved me.
Oh my God.
And I was like, wow, I've really bonded with Mike Tyson. You're like, we are friends for life, because if you have that sort of experience, you assume that's going to be the case. So we're in Vegas. I went out with the crew. The next day was just a bit of filming, like some photos and bits and pieces. So we went out and, you know, celebrated this bizarre yet potentially awesome day. And then the next day we came back. And I was like, oh, going to see my mate Mike again.
Like,
should we hug again? I walked over and he goes, hey, I'm Mike Tyson.
Oh.
He did not remember me from the day before. So we haven't got that bond that I thought we might have.
Wow. Hey, you know what? You got the memory though.
Yeah, I've got the memory. I'm not sure that Mike has the memory, but
wow. What an interesting man. Eh?
Yeah, fascinating. And I guess it makes sense why. Look, when you think about it, he had a very, very tough childhood.
Yeah, very traumatic.
Then he got punched in the head a lot. Mm. Even though he punched other people brutally, he got punched in the head a lot. Then who knows the extent of his addictions. Mm. People have ripped him off left, right and center. He's ended up in prison. He's done some terrible things, clearly. And at the end of it all, people want to put him in front of cameras and get his opinion on this and that. So stuff comes out and he is, you know, just dealing with life, I think, in whatever way he sees best at this point.
A kid from Brooklyn, you know, when we talk about superstardom, I don't think people realize we've got superstars today for sure, but I do believe that because social media has gives you access, there's almost this mystique is a little bit less.
Yeah.
I don't, like, Mike Tyson at his prime was like almost a god.
Yeah.
Like a god. It would be very bizarre, his world.
Oh, it would be crazy. And you think about, like, his viewership figures at that time and the star that he was. Mm. And now he's about to fight against an influencer turned boxer. And it'll probably be the most watched boxing event since he last had a monster boxing event.
Yeah.
Like, that's how big he is.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be, well, I assume it's going to be free on Netflix.
Yeah, I think it is going to be free to subscribers, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's not going to be pay-per-view. Yeah. So you would think the audience on that, particularly through North America, is going to be insane. So
I think 280 million subscribers they have.
Yeah.
So you'd have to say at least 30 to 40 million will tune in.
You'd have to think
so. Surely.
And then they're going to do it in Texas, so they'll get they'll get 30 or 40,000 people there, you'd think, maybe more. And they're going to be relentless in their marketing. And Mike, I know from experience, sometimes if you ask him to do stuff in a marketing sense, he just won't. But for this, clearly he's invested, because you look at the videos and the content that are coming out around his training, and people are going, oh, can he – and you go like, no, wait, he's 57. Like, he's an old man. He has a walking stick. But people are going to buy in. Mainstream people are going to buy in, and everyone is going to watch that.
I'm so torn on this one, how to feel. I don't know how to feel because...
Well, also, we don't know what it is.
Yeah, is it a real bout? Is it an, like, is it...
Can't be a real fight.
Exhibit fight or whatever. But I'm torn how to feel on it because, like, I feel like a legend of the sport getting dropped by Jake Paul is disgraceful. Like, Jake Paul... You've been relatively expected, welcomed into the sport. I know there's been a lot of purists that haven't liked it, but look, I'm not a huge fan of Jake Paul as a person, but he has committed to the sport. He's not just an influencer. Like, he is, but you know what I'm saying.
He clearly works hard.
He works hard and he actually trains at boxing. But surely you have enough respect for the sport to go, me knocking a legend out like that, is it worth the money you're going to get?
I don't think that he does.
So like that.
Yeah. Like, I think when it's that much money and when that's where he's driven his life, I think it cancels everything out. But you say, like, yeah, it would be awful if Jake Paul knocks out Mike Tyson. But then, and it's so disgusting that you think, but what if Tyson knocks out Jake Paul? But he can't because he's 57 and he walks with a walking stick. Like, he legitimately does. But, I don't know. It's a car crash.
Yeah.
But everyone's going to watch it. And that's the thing with all of the crossover stuff and all the freak show stuff, and this is firmly freak show, is that if people are going to pay for it, then promoters are going to put it on.
It's prize fighting.
Yeah. So, and it's been going on forever. And people always go, like, when we have our footy fights, people are like, oh, this is a disgrace or whatever. Like, well, some people do, and then heaps of other people buy it. But then you go, well, it's not really. Like, Muhammad Ali fought a sumo wrestler.
Yeah.
Like, this is not new. This is what happens. People want to watch this stuff, so people are going to put it on. So if everyone stopped watching it, it wouldn't happen. But it's something that attracts an audience.
People pay, you know, their money is really what they're saying, not necessarily what they're saying. It's where their money goes is what they're saying.
And I think a lot of those people probably put the comments, this is a disgrace, and then go and buy the fight.
I think so too. I think also... You know, if you know boxing, or not if you know boxing, apologies. Like, I'm a fan, a bit more than a casual fan, but just underneath a hardcore fan or whatever. But, like, when you look at the standard of fights, if you went to your local RSL, you would see guys coming through that have those standard of fights too. But because you're so used to only just seeing the, you know, I know that they're not superstars or, you know, but these are the cream of the crop that you see on these cards. So you may not be aware that, you know, all boxing doesn't look like that. You're seeing the best of this area on a main event card. So for footy players, yeah, I get it. They, you know, their technique's terrible, their cardio's terrible, but you get that down at the local RSL as well. And that's the level that they're at, local RSL. Their name is what puts them in there.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that they get pushed ahead of where they probably should be in a boxing sense, but that's because of the audience. Again, it's because people want to watch that and because promoters know that people are going to tune in to have a look at that. So... you don't like to victim blame, but the audience is the problem.
Yeah, mate.
Sorry, guys.
Exactly. The promoters are just providing what the audience, deep down, what they really want. I will say, what's it been like for you personally watching that? Because a lot of people, the argument is, a spot is being taken away from an actual boxer that's put his life into it. My argument against that is that it's not like there's a pool of money and then it just gets given out to a certain amount of people. Money is only given to what is generated.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. And it's, look, if we had it my way, then every boxing event in Australia would command a massive audience. And people would want to go to the Bankstown Trotting Track this Saturday night and watch the Paul Nazari Neutral Corner promotion. And that would be packed. Yeah. People would want to go to all these shows and these fighters would be mainstream stars. But the reality of it is that is not the case. And you're right, there's not a pool of money. There is money that people are willing to spend. There is an audience that are going to choose what they want to watch. And if they're choosing this over that, you can't blame anyone really except for the situation. So I think the best thing that has happened in Australian boxing in recent times, obviously we've got really good promoters and at the very top of it, No Limit, who are doing a great job, but we've got really committed networks. We've got a machine in not just Fox Sports and KO and Main Event, but also, you know, the papers and everything online and the outdoor advertising and everything else that comes with it that are driving people towards making these people stars.
Yeah.
We just need to continue to make those stars and boxing as a mainstream product, as we've seen through Tim Zoo, can continue to prosper and will always prosper, I think. But I don't think there's any point in having bitterness about some people taking a share outside of others. Yeah. At least we've got the sport in a good spot. We've got a committed network and others who are, you know, dipping the toe and hopefully embracing as well. Mm. So, yeah, it's tricky. And I and as a boxer, it would be difficult and you would easily become jealous because yeah, you're for fighting sure. for very little compared to some of these guys who are clearly getting a lot more and you're probably a lot better than them. But
yeah.
it's just the situation as it is. You know, yeah. it's a pity, but it is what it is.
Now, in regards to Australian boxing events, is there any huge moments that stand out for you, like a fight that you were at or something crazy that happened behind the scenes, or, you know, anything like that?
Well, it's got to be Horn Pacquiao. Like yeah. It's 52,052 people at Suncorp Stadium. A school teacher from Brisbane, a nerdy school teacher.
Yeah. Unorthodox fighter. It's, you know, not pretty to watch.
Bashes Manny Pacquiao. And he won that fight. Mm. I have no doubt he won that fight. I understand that people don't like to accept things like that happening, particularly if you're a Manny Pacquiao fan, and who isn't? I'm a Manny Pacquiao fan. Mm. And particularly for the American audience who didn't like the look of Horn and the way that he fought, and the Filipino audience who hated the fact that he was so rough to a legend, which he had to be. But to be there as an Australian, as someone who knew Jeff Horn, who'd been on the journey with him for a long time, I was fortunate to be there at the Olympic Games when he fought and to watch his entire professional career over in New Zealand on those Joseph Parker undercards and here in Australia when we started to invest in his journey at Fox Sports. And then to see him go into that fight, which when it was talked about at the start, you're like, that can't happen. There's no way Manny Pacquiao is coming to Australia to fight that guy. Like, what are we talking about? But it happened. Mm. And now, forever, if anyone goes, hey, is this story real? Can this new thing ever really happen? You're like, well, Manny Pacquiao came to Australia and fought Jeff Horn, and Jeff Horn beat him. So, yes, that can happen. Anything can happen. But the moment was just crazy, and to be in the ring like between the two of them afterwards and interviewing Jeff and like his face hanging off and Manny, and to have Manny and Freddie Freddie Roach say to me in the ring in their interviews to admit defeat and say that the better man won and to be so gracious before it all turned around, obviously, because what Teddy Atlas did and what transpired, but just to be a part of that in the middle of that was one of those insane moments. It was a phenomenal like day.
It was out in the open too, wasn't
it? Yeah, and it was hot.
It was hot.
Yeah,
warm Queensland day.
Yeah,
and it really is
black suit.
Oh, like, mate, you're really sweating.
Yeah,
just
got sunburned during the fights. Like, I think Jeff Horn got sunburned during the fights. Like, but he also got his face sliced to ribbons. So.
It really is one of those moments, though, that, you know, in 20 years' time, and, you know, you're talking about the legends of the sport, obviously Manny Pacquiao absolutely is going to be brought up as one of the greatest ever, but it will be a lot of Australians almost, you know, back in my day, there was a battler called Jeff Horn, and was he necessarily the greatest fighter of all? Like, no, probably not. He was a battler.
Yeah.
But he beat Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah,
and I was there and I saw it.
And the great contrast, and there's so many within boxing. Sebastian Fundora that Tim Zhu's about to fight, he's a bit of one of those guys. He's a nerd. He's a really, really nice dude.
Yeah.
But he's also just a killer.
Yeah.
Jeff Horn is like that. Like what he does nowadays is he plays board games with his wife at nighttime and plays with the kids.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. But he went out and did that to Manny Pacquiao and he survived round 9.
Crazy
against
survival.
Against Pacquiao and came back and won arguably won the last 3 rounds of that fight. So just the contrast and the contradiction that he is as a person that was quite phenomenal. And there's been, you know, some brilliant occasions. I was very fortunate to call the Jai Pitaya fight against Myres Bradis when he broke his jaw.
I wanted to speak about his Jai Pitaya.
Broke his jaw in 2 places. I did the world's most ridiculous ring interview with him after I'd called that fight where he couldn't speak. Just like those sorts of moments. And then all the Tim Zhu bits and pieces that we've been so lucky to have and how big he continues to get. And being in Germany with Daniel Gill and calling his world title fight and lots of others. And a great fight as well. Probably the best, the most dramatic fight aside from probably Opetire and Bradis. Jeff Horn against Michael Zarafa 2, the punch from the gods in round 9 again when he was gone and he produced that shot. And that's the first time I think that I've just lost it in commentary where the moment shocked me so much. I sort of just screamed something and But yeah, so many great moments. It's phenomenal where we're at in the sport in this country at the moment.
Joey Opetai.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he is a guy that probably could have benefited from being on Footy Cards, because I don't think the wider audience know how incredible this guy's run is at the moment and how much of a boogeyman he is in his division. Like, he is genuinely struggling to get a fight with the top tier. That's how good he is. Now, whether that's because they're, you know, scared, whatever. I've never say a boxer is scared, but certain things don't line up. But he is truly the boogeyman of his division. He's fast, he's fit, he's explosive, and he has knockout power. What are your thoughts on Joey Opetai?
Yeah, he's someone who, again, we've been blessed to see all the way through. He was at that 2012 Olympics as well with that all-star team, and was the youngest boxing Olympian we've ever had. And everyone knew that there was something about him. And we knew that for years and years, but we never saw it until... Well, we never really saw it until that night against Bratis. When
one
we saw what he was...
I've ever seen.
We found out what he was as a person, like what was at his core, and we found out that it was something really special. But on that same night, I think he found that out as well.
Yeah,
because you can't know how you're going to react to that. And he, talking to him like a week out from the fight and a few days out, like, he was speaking differently. I knew there was something about him, but he was about to fight for a world title. It was the culmination of his whole life. So you expect him to speak like that. But then when it all went down and you could tell, and in commentary, because I was pretty close to him, I could tell his face was hanging off.
His mouth was open whilst he's fighting with blood pouring down it.
And then he went at the other guy. Like in that last round, you could tell, because he's there's a great moment where he tries to talk to him and looks at his mouth in between rounds, between the second last and the last round, and he sees what he's like. He goes, oh. And you're like, oh, what are they going to do? Like, they have to send him back out, I guess. But like, oh, do you really want to? And so he goes back out and he doesn't run. No. Like, he goes towards the guy and starts trading again. You're like, what are you doing?
Insane.
So yeah, just an unbelievable performance. And something that just showed exactly what he's always had and what he now knows that he has, that's made him this ruthless killer that he's become.
And the guy he fought actually went to a split decision. I'm forgetting his name. He's gone up to heavyweight now. He's one of the pound for pound of the best.
So Morris Brader's fought against Alexander Usyk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he's beaten Joshua twice or three times.
Twice, yes.
Twice. He's going to fight Fury.
Yep.
So we're talking about a guy that's gone up to heavyweight and dusted some of the best in the world. Brader's was a split decision loss to him?
Yeah, one of them gave it a draw.
And said Opetai has gotten a broken jaw. Didn't he break it twice early and then later?
So
he
broke it on one side and then later he broke it on the other side. So effectively it was just connected by skin. So I spoke to the ringside doctor straight after the fight, and he said, I forgot what it's called. It's a something, something, something.
Yeah.
But I spoke to the doctor and I said, does that often happen when it breaks one side? Does it make it looser? And he goes, well, how would we know? Once they break one side, people stop what they're doing and get an operation.
Oh.
But he kept going and kept taking shots. So phenomenal. And the recovery was awful. He couldn't speak. He couldn't eat for a long time.
Eating through a straw, he would have.
Through a straw. But like it just instilled the belief in him. And now he fights Bratis again. So he's going to fight Bratis to get his old title back, because boxing got in the way, as it always does, and he lost his title. So now he fights Bratis again on that card with Fury and Usyk, who are fighting for the undisputed heavyweight world title in Saudi Arabia, of all places. But he's right at the pinnacle. He's the best cruiserweight in the world, but he just has to prove it now against Bratis again. Mm. Bratis is a couple of years older, but he's still a brute.
Bratis is a couple of years older for sure. But Opetai is 2 years better, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's a substantially better fighter than he was when he fought him the first time.
Yeah, I think it's a belief thing again.
Yeah.
Hopefully his body's right, because he did have an injury which was going to force him to pull out the first time around. So he was not going – so he's got a calf injury. But he should be fine now. Yeah, he should be fine now. But he was
– didn't he have an operation, though, on his hand as well?
Oh, he's had – he's had a lot of operations. Okay. Yeah, his hand. He's obviously had the jaw things. But he actually. So that fight has been put back together, the Fury Usyk fight, because Fury had that massive cut.
Yep.
So that got pushed back.
Yeah.
But that same day, Opetai had actually pulled out of the Bratis fight
because of a calf injury.
Okay. So he was very fortunate that Fury got cut.
Yep.
A bit of fate. So he retains his spot as the co-main event on that show, because otherwise who knows what would have happened with that IBF Cruiserweight World title.
Now, mate, I'm not sure if you're a predictions man, but obviously everyone can order the fight on KO. You don't need a KO subscription, but we need to get behind our boy Timmy Zhu, because after this, there may be a Terence Crawford in the sights. But are you a predictions man or not a prediction?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to.
What's your prediction for the fight against Fandora?
Jeez, it's just happened. It's hard to think. But I tell you, the thing about Sebastian Fandora, having dealt, as I do, really closely with the Rose Boys and with Tim's journey, he's the guy who I've always thought, let's stay away from him. Because he's a 6'6" southpaw who can punch and is happy to trade on the inside. Well, that's not a thing. They don't happen.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know how Tim lines up against him. I think Tim probably beats anyone, but geez, like, that's a guy that you're like, we'll just assume he's going to beat that guy rather than testing it. So to take it on 12 days notice when he's been preparing for a veteran who fights orthodox and throws quite traditional punches, even though he bounces in Keith Thurman, when you know that Fandora was training and preparing for someone who's not hugely dissimilar to Tim, he's fit and also his sparring has been relevant, there would be a school of thought that Tim should not have taken this fight. But he took 10 seconds to decide to take it. That's the mindset that he has, which is great, really. Yeah. So with that said, I think Tim wins. I think Tim wins. And I think that what plays into his hands in this fight is the fact that Fandora is a big guy, but he's a big guy who's happy to stay on the inside with you. Tim will be able to pressure him. He's not going to try and keep him at bay with a long jab or anything. Fandora is happy to trade. So Tim's pressure will still be relevant in this fight. He'll find Fandora in front of him. I think it'll be a brilliant fight. He has good fights, Fandora, and Tim obviously has great fights. He can be hit, which we saw in his fight, Fandora's fight against Brian Mendoza, but he'd won every second of that fight up until that point. So Tim needs to hit him and hit him hard, or he's not going anywhere. But I think he can do it. I think he can break him down. I don't know if he can stop him. He'd have to hit him with, you know, a hammer like what Fandora did to stop this guy. But if he could stop Sebastian Fandora, that would be phenomenal. But I think he will out-pressure him and he should win this fight.
What do you... So I recently was watching a lot of interviews just to get up to date on Fandora's kind of mindset. And one key thing that stood out to me was he said that this whole camp before Tim Zhu was all about boxing smarter, because obviously heaps of range. Why would you be fighting on the inside with so much? Your number one asset, you don't use it. Do you think there is a chance by him saying that we've been going smart boxing, the first few rounds he might try to use range?
I think he'll box at range until instinct
kicks in.
And it won't take long, I don't think, with a guy like that, because he's a hard dude. He doesn't seem like it. You'll talk to him, no doubt.
Yep.
He doesn't feel like that. He feels like he shouldn't be doing this, but he is an animal. So he will use his smarts, and I think he might try and jab for a while, but it's not what he does.
Yeah.
He'll end up in front of Tim and they'll go to war. He's a really fascinating dude, actually. I went over when another Australian, Daniel Lewis, fought against him in Vegas, actually, and interviewed Sebastian Fandora a few times and have dealt with him a fair bit since, actually. His favourite character, bizarrely, in the world was Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter.
What?
He's all into Australian animals.
I respect him.
Yeah. and he's an environmentalist and a conservationist.
Okay.
So he's got all these different strings to his bows. But he's really passionate about Steve Irwin. He was speaking to me.
Really?
I watched an interview I did, like, it's four or five years ago, but I watched an interview I did with him, and he's speaking about all this stuff, and it was just like, what are you talking about? You're fighting this dude in, like, 24 hours.
He's savage.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, yeah. And he was, like, talking to his new Australian fans and all that sort of stuff. So he's a very different, quirky guy. His sister's a world champion as well, so there's pressure on him.
Yep.
And now there's two world titles at stake. He's a really likable dude, but this is going to be a really rough and ready fight, because they're two guys who are happy to take shots, will stand in front of each other, and this is a better fight than the Thurman fight. The Thurman fight was good because Thurman's a name, like a big name, great character, speaks really well, entertaining, but this is a better fight and a tougher fight for Tim as well, I think. I was really confident with the Thurman fight. This fight, there's a little bit of you that goes, oh, that's going to be really nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Like watching that Aussie dude against that giant and wondering what's going to happen. Like, this is a really stressful fight. And there's nothing better as someone who's obviously obsessed with boxing. There's nothing better than being ringside overseas while there's an Aussie in a major fight that you're really nervous about. But it can go horribly,
yeah,
as it has many times when I've been in different places. But when it goes well,
the best.
It's the best feeling.
I am going to go Tim Zhu. Sorry, let me get this right. I'm going to go Timmy Zhu body shot. Body rip ends the fight, but he'll drop him multiple times from the body shot. It won't be the first body shot. It'll be the second or third. There you go.
Yeah. Well, I think the body shot makes sense, given there's a lot of that body.
Yeah, yeah. He's almost that body height.
Yeah, and there's not much, theoretically, there's not much covering his organs, so yep, body shots should hurt. He's been hurt from body shots before against Erickson Lubin and others. So, yeah, I think you might be right. There's every chance. And it would be a huge statement if Tim were to do that, particularly this occasion.
Yeah.
Over there, everyone watching, headlining, and now the clear A side in this promotion, because previously he was battling for that with Keith Thurman. It was Thurman Zhu. Now it is Zhu Fundora unified world title fight. It is the biggest stage, and it's such a big opportunity. But Tim Zhu knows he belongs. He's sure that he deserves this, and I think that people are going to see a really special fight and a really memorable performance.
Mate, thank you so much for coming on, brother. I really do appreciate it. And do they follow Ben Damon on Instagram? Is there,
if they want, go they nuts. Want? Yeah, okay, go okay. nuts. Yeah, I am on all those things.
Okay.
Don't do a lot on it, but it's there if you
make sure
you
follow jump and on. Also look hard for Le Champion. Is that
Have a look for that. Or more importantly, go and look up that fight that I said, Sakio Bicker against Jadon Condrington, or any of the fights we've discussed. If you haven't watched those, you can find most of them, and also a bunch of them that we've done on recent No Limit cards. There was that great female fight, Chanel Dargan, and the other girl whose name just escapes me for a moment, which was a brilliant fight. You can find on YouTube. There's so many good fights. Just go and have a look at them and see everything that's happening in Australian boxing, because it's exciting. There's a lot of up and coming fighters, a lot of established good fighters, and the rest of this year and beyond is going to be huge. But it all starts when we go to Vegas next week.
Oh, cannot wait. Thanks so much, brother. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll see you in Vegas.